When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're journeying out of Liverpool for this week's episode to Abbey Road Studios to speak to the son of legendary Beatles producer George Martin. As well as being a hugely successful music producer in his own right, Giles Martin worked with his dad on the Love album for the Cirque du Soleil show of the same name. He has since remastered a number of Beatles albums, including the pioneering 1967 record Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. A new Dolby Atmos version of the music is being launched here in Liverpool later this week, giving fans an immersive experience that aims to sound as though the band is playing live in the space. I was lucky enough to experience this in a special preview at Abbey Road before meeting Giles to find out more. I'm Laura Davis, and this is Beatles City. So I'm here at Abbey Road Studios with Giles Martin. Thank you so much for having us along.
Oh, thank you for coming.
I've just been in the studio and had the extraordinary experience of listening to Sgt. Pepper's, as it will be in Liverpool. It's quite an overwhelming experience, really.
Yeah, I'm pleased you enjoyed it. I think it's, it's just a new way of listening, and it's a new way of listening to old music. But music doesn't get old. Recordings don't get old. I mean, you know, the Beatles will always be the same age when they were captured on that tape. And I think it's a celebration of that. It's almost like time travel. You can walk into a room nowadays through technology, it's like you're in this room with the same people. And it's beautiful. I think it's to be an amazing experience for people in Liverpool.
Why do you even begin with something like this?
Oh, that's a good question. You begin with the record. I mean, the actual original album, made, what is it, 53 years ago now, is an extraordinary piece of work. It's an extraordinary piece of artwork, really. You can now look back at them. Now, I know that, you know, from my dad being George Martin and now me working for the Beatles, I know that at the time they didn't think it would last 53 years. And that's the thing about, you know, people, you know, painters make paintings, artists make recordings, you know, musicians make recordings, you know, composers compose songs, and they do it for the psyche of the time. They do it because they want to react against something. Sgt. Pepper's was that. And I think that you start with thinking, okay, this is a moment in time. This Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is a moment in time that sort of changed the world of music. And that's where you start. You start by respecting it, but then thinking about, okay, how can we take the listener or take people elsewhere?
So you're having a very different experience in that they're thinking about making something of the time, but you're thinking about how it's been around for so long and everybody loves it and you're creating something for the future, would you say?
I don't think I'd be that arrogant, actually, but they've trained me, and my dad did. I mean, the first project I did was Love, which was still a show that's going on in Vegas now, but it was a sort of collage of Beatles music, which I chopped together and with the guidance of my father. And one of the things that the Beatles instilled in me, Paul McCartney especially, sort of said, you know, your job isn't to necessarily respect it. Your job is to work on it. Your job is to do things with our music. And, you know, this immersive audio format, this Dolby Atmos format, which we're doing at the Tate in Liverpool, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was the very first record ever to be mixed in this new format, which I think is brilliant. It's worthy of the Beatles because they always push technologies. They always push technology here at Abbey Road. And I suppose my job is to make sure that those boundaries are consistently being pushed. And for the Beatles, I mean, their catalogue, their work is by far the most successful and heralded popular music there's been. And it's my responsibility to make sure that everyone gets a chance to listen to it. And I think that pushing technology or creating new experiences with people gets new generations involved. And so, yes, I suppose in that way it's for the future as well.
So hearing that you don't have to respect it, although I imagine you do still respect it, was that incredibly freeing for you?
Yeah, when I say not respect it, I suppose that what that means is that I'm not trying to replicate what they did 50 years ago. That's not what my job is. I have to take artistic decisions based on sound because I'm working on a different format. I've got a different canvas, if you like, to work on. And so, you know, if you think about the experience that you just listened to or the experience that people are going to have at the Tate in Liverpool, is very different from the experience of 1967 when you had a mono speaker in your house and you'd listen to, you know, Sgt. Pepper's with really not many high frequencies or low frequencies, even though they're there on the record. So I'm sort of working a different format, and that means that I suppose in a way, my approach to music is always that it's never quite how you remember it being. And I try and make it so it's how you remember it, but it's not quite that. I worked on this, Olivia Harrison employed me to do a George Harrison documentary called Living in the Material World. And it was directed by Martin Scorsese. And they hired me, and then she fired me. She said, Martin doesn't like your revisionist approach to music. And I went, oh, okay, fair enough. I'm not going to argue with Martin Scorsese. And then about a month later, they phoned me up and said, the music doesn't sound how we remember it. And I'd done a mix of All Things Must Pass in 5-1 at that stage for the movie. Mm-hmm. And I met Martin Scorsese in London. And I said, there's two buttons here. You can choose which one is the one you remember. And he went, this is how it should sound. This is what I remember. And of course, that was the mix we did for the film. And the one that he didn't like was the one from the vinyl record.
Wow.
And that's what you mean. You know, if it's our tastes and our expectations have moved on. If you imagine, the greatest example is actually if someone watches a highlights reel from a sports or an Olympics or a football match, the FA Cup, whatever it is, or the last time Liverpool won the championship, if you remember it, you don't remember the pictures being that bad. And music is the same. And so you kind of expect it to sound amazing.
So that's the difference. People remember it sounding better.
Yeah, you remember it sounding better because we fill in the gaps. It's like, you know, I'm old enough to grow up on AM radio, but then FM radio came along and we loved the songs. We loved the music. I had a cassette Walkman, which wasn't a posh Walkman. It was like made by a company that doesn't exist anymore that only had Fast Forward on it. And those little orange headphones. And I listened to Lloyd Cole and the Commotions or bands like that on my cassette player, and then it sounded the best it's ever sounded, but of course it probably sounded terrible.
Yeah.
But we fill in the gaps. And so in a way, what I do is fill in the gaps. And then when kids hear it, it doesn't sound like it's something their parents should listen to. They discover it for the first time, if that makes sense. Because it doesn't, you know, recordings don't get old. We get old. Recordings stay the same age. You know, that's their time capsules, as I said before. So My job is to go, okay, open this time capsule and you're back in the room with them.
So I often feel quite envious when I interview people about the Beatles and they talk about going out and getting a record and playing it for the first time and it being completely new. Because for me, the music has just always been there. But that's sort of what you're doing.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you sort of listen to it again, but for the first time, in a way.
Mm.
You know, you just listen to Sgt. Pepper in there. And I bet it was a different experience from if you just, you know, that album. You know, you heard things before you hadn't heard or felt differently.
Mm.
And that's what we're kind of trying to do.
And the experience of just sitting and listening to it as well.
Well, that's another thing. That's the funny thing that, you know, that people like me get credit for. But you just lock someone in a room. You know, they have no choice. It's when I did the Cirque show, which is now 13 years ago, I was concerned that, you know, because it was the first big show that was just reliant on playback and no additional musicians. And I was concerned how people would react to that. And I went to a Big Top, which Cirque du Soleil were making in Montreal, to go and play Yesterday. Because I knew I wouldn't be able to do anything with Yesterday. I mean, I'd remix it and, you know, put the strings in surround or whatever, you know, try different things with it. But it's going to sound like Yesterday. And I just played the CD through a PA system. And everyone was working, and they all just stopped and listened. It was just loud.
Really, they just paused.
I hadn't done anything. I was just playing the record that the Beatles made. And it's that thing of, you know, we hear music, we don't listen to it, you know. That we look at our phones, we need visual impetus. I'm guilty of it as much as anyone else is, you know. And not there's any right or wrong, but sometimes it's a bit like meditation in a way, isn't it? Sometimes it's nice to only rely on one sense, and then you free up your other senses to wander off and do other things. So if you're just listening and not looking, you're I suppose part of your brain is freed up from that strain, and you get taken to other places. A bit like reading a book.
So practically, how did you go about remixing the album?
Well, practically it was challenging. I mean, one thing we can do first up, which I knew from the beginning, you know, back from when we did Love, actually, is we can take the... Sgt. Pepper's was recorded on a four-track one-inch tape machine, and then it was bounced. So, you know, you'd record, or they would record, Little Help My Friends, I think, is piano, bass, drums, and guitars on four-track, and then that's bounced down to another track. Or maybe not bass, on a separate track, and then
so
vocals
you put them
are added.
Together into one.
And so we can put them into, so we can use the 4x4, so we have more tracks than they had to choose from. Mm-hmm. And then because it's Dolby Atmos, sometimes we'll... The appealing thing about an immersive audio system is you can actually put people in the room with the band. But no one really recorded the room, the sound of the room, so we'll go back to Studio 2 and we might play the instruments back through Studio 2 and record the walls. So we create more tracks. So we create ambience. So opposed to it being an effect, it's real. It's the, because Studio 2, which we're next to now, hasn't changed. You know, hasn't changed in years. I mean, it hasn't changed since the Beatles were in there. So it's the same room. So we can, with good speakers and, you know, good microphones, record the walls of the room, and so we can put you in the room with the band. And that's the one thing you get from listening to this and experiencing it. You feel sort of closer to the music. And to be honest with you, in a bizarre way, it's almost stripping back layers of technology in order to get you closer to it. I mean, if you get a Beatles 4-track now, and put it on a tape machine and press play, it sounds remarkably fresh and clear. There's all those processes that go between to make it onto a record, make it onto a vinyl record. There's a lot of process involved. You know, you have to, you know, there's lots of copies done. Where, in a way, the reason why this sounds so fresh is it's almost from farm to table, as the Americans would say.
And was there anything that surprised you about the music when you were listening back to it?
With Sgt. Pepper's, actually how well it was recorded in lots of ways, you know, because I then did the White Album after that, and I've now just done Abbey Road. Sgt. Pepper's was beautifully recorded, you know, a better recording than most recordings that happen now. You know, the quality of everything on it is amazing. Not overall. Some tracks, I remember, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is a funny recording in a way. I said to my dad, doesn't sound as good as the others. He goes, oh, we did it very quickly, he said to me. Fixing a Hole was done in another studios and has a certain sound to it. But yeah, it's a record. You can see that from the outset there was a determination to make a different record. And they had a blueprint, and they had a plan, and they stuck to their plan, and that's what they did. The White Album was basically just jamming in a room and let's come up with a bunch of songs, where Sgt. Pepper's was very meticulous.
So when you're looking at it like that, then you're thinking about it as a whole. You're not, when you think about the album, you're not going, I'll deal with this track and then this track. You are thinking about the whole thing.
But it's weird, Sgt. Pepper. It's a bit like all these albums, a bit like Stockholm Syndrome. You sort of get, you know, I don't listen to the records unless I'm working on them. You know, we don't listen to them at home. It's funny, Mike, you know, before I said the White Album, I asked my wife and kids if they could name any song off the White Album. They couldn't. I mean, it's not part of their world. It's interesting. So it's not as though I take it home with me. And Sgt. Pepper's, I just found it amazing. It is a bit like Stockholm Syndrome. You sort of feel like you're chained to a radiator and you fall in love with your captor. And I felt that with Sgt. Pepper, that you suddenly realise that there's layers of respect you get for it. And as I start from the, you know, say from the point of no respect, which isn't true, but as far as it sound wise, you go into this world where you're thinking, okay, who would put Within You Without You, and then follow that by When I'm 64. You know, no band in their right minds would have such an eclectic mix of songs on an album that is so eclectic that it kind of makes sense as a whole. Mm. You know, there's no singles on the record. If you think about the iconic songs that are on that album, and you know, we talked for a while about when we remixed it about Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields. And a lot of fans going, they need to be on that album. And I sat down with Paul and we talked about it, and it's like, well, where would you put it? You know, where do you know it? You know, you're kind of, that's how it is.
Mm.
So it's a bit like, it's a bit gruesome. It's a bit like, you know, opening up a 50-year-old body, but finding out everything is perfectly in place and they're incredibly healthy. That's what working with Sgt. Pepper's like.
Did you work closely with Paul and Ringo on it? How involved were they?
We work in a way where I'll go off and do the work, and then we get together and I'll play it to them, go through everything with them, and go and visit them. I'll play them stuff. In Ringo is in LA a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
With this Atmos mix, Paul came up and listened to this with Mary, his daughter, who I'm really good friends with. It was great, actually. It was a really sort of emotional experience. They know that, you know, I don't necessarily to further my career. It's not as though I go in Hollywood saying, yes, I'm the guy who mixed the Beatles records, or, you know, it's not a, they know that I love them and I love the music, and they're incredibly kind to me about, you know, giving me the freedom at the same time. I know what they sort of like, if that makes sense.
I suppose you've known them your whole life,
haven't you? Yeah, yeah. And I know Yoko and Olivia very well as well. And they have to look after their husband's legacies in a way. So they're powerful, and but there's a, we have a momentum behind it, which is, you know, it's been over 13 years, that I, longer than the Beatles were going, that I've been working on their music. Passed down from my dad, I guess, and so it's a fairly easy relationship. And the great thing about it is, there's no other voices. It's them and it's me and that's it. There's no record company meetings or playbacks for A&R people. I mean, I did this film Rocket Man this year.
Mm.
I did the music for that, and we did a soundtrack album. The soundtrack has like 26 songs. I had to get them done really quickly. And while I was in the film, there's an A&R team who were great, but they're like going, at 1:26, we can hear some sibilance on the vocal. And I suddenly thought, what is going on? Why are these people giving me opinions? I mean, of course, they're probably right, but it's like, it was completely unusual for me. I don't normally have that.
Yeah.
It was really weird. And I said, eventually said to her, listen, I can't work like this. I mean, it's not going to be perfect. That's all I can say. I don't make perfect records. What do you want me to do?
Could you have done Sgt. Pepper and the other albums and not been your father's son, do you think? Did that give you a freedom or access, maybe?
Yeah, listen, I think that the better way of asking that question is, could anyone else do a better job than you? And I think, yes, they could. There's lots of really good people around. I mean, I know some brilliant mix engineers and, you know, musicians and, you know, yeah, of course. People used to ask, what's it like having George Martin as a dad? And you go, well, I don't know, I don't really know anything else. It's a weird, you know, it's a strange thing, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's like me asking you, you know, what's it like having your dad as a dad? Would it be any different if you had a different dad?
Mm. And it's be hard, a different person, wouldn't
it?
Yeah, suppose.
It's a hard thing to answer. Absolutely, there's an acceptance, both within the Beatles and outside of the Beatles especially, more so, I think, that, oh, well, this makes sense. There's like a fit for everyone. You know, I can't think about it. I'd sort of sound like my dad, I look a bit like my dad. It's like, you know, and it's a weird thing. And the last thing, I was lucky that in a way it happened late. In a way, I was 32 or 33 when I started work on Beatles stuff.
Mm.
Or maybe later than that.
You'd already proven yourself at that point.
Well, to a certain extent, I mean, I'd had sold records and stuff like that. But I think that, you know, I think it's more the psychotherapy than that. You know, I didn't have to, you know, there's a, it's funny, I produced an album with Paul, an album called New. It was funny doing that because he's the one person, bizarre, that doesn't compare me to my dad in a strange way, because he knows us both really well, if that makes sense. Mm. I'm a separate entity to him. He said to me, he said, you know, it was incredibly kind. He said, you know, he was actually religious as Sergeant Pepper. He said, you know, this is, he goes, this sounds great. This sounds amazing. You know, we are a really good band. I said, yeah. I said, these sounds yours. He goes, no, we're really lucky to have your dad, and we're really lucky to have you. And I said, well, listen, Paul, I'm pretty lucky that you asked me to do this. And he goes, well, I think we're all lucky, aren't we? And it was just a really sweet conversation. Yeah. And there's no doubt that I wouldn't. I got the job because of my father's son. I think also, without sounding cocky, if I couldn't do it, it's not a charity.
You know,
the Beatles are quite hardcore. Oh no, you wouldn't. I mean, you wouldn't survive. You know, you're dealing with, to be honest with you, take the Beatles to one side, you're dealing with the fans as well, and the forums and the people that, you know, Mrs. Trellis from, give us a clue, Mrs. Trellis in Wales, writes in, you know, there's, you get, and I was surprised. In fact, Sgt. Pepper's was the first album remix we did. And I was really unsure whether I wanted to do it, actually. And my father had just died. Mm. And I said to the Beatles, I said, listen, let me go in and do some tracks. This is the stereo. This is before the Atmos. Mm-hmm. And see whether it's worth doing. Because if it's not worth, why are we doing this? My job isn't to make Beatles ashtrays or wigs or, you know, that's not my job. My job is to see whether, if this is worth listening to. And I was surprised, you know, through the technology and through having to use the previous version of the four tracks. If you think about, we're mixing from versions of four tracks that they'd never mix from. You know, they're actually bizarrely fresher tapes than they used when they made the record, because they're not copies. And I phoned them, I said, this could be quite good. We could do this. And that's the way it worked. And then you think, you know, how are people going to react to this? And then when the Sgt. Pepper remixed album came out, I think at that year it got 100% metadata critics. Like, it didn't get any, I mean, probably should do, but didn't get any criticism. Mm. You know, everyone was happy, and that was like, I mean, you move on, you don't really think about that, but at the same time you think, well, you know, maybe there's something beyond just being my dad's son that's worthwhile. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And being here in Abbey Road and your role here now, I mean, did you imagine that? Did you grow up coming into the studio? Did you know it extremely
No, I spent a lot of time at Air Studios, which is the studio. My dad moved from Abbey Road and built Air Studios, which is originally Oxford Circus, and then they moved to Hampstead. And I was up there working Thursday, Friday last week, mm-hmm. on another project. And it's a lovely place as well. I didn't really come to Abbey Road. I came to Abbey Road when I was 19. My dad was worried about the brightness. And my dad started losing his hearing, but he was worried about his ears. He's worried about the brightness, the Red and the Blue albums, the reissues, and I came in to talk to him about it and met an old engineer who thought I was some young upstart, you know, which I probably was. And that was the first time I came to Abbey Road, but it really wasn't my home. I never thought I'd work on Beatles stuff. I had really no ambitions to. I didn't, you know, I helped on the anthologies a bit because, again, I was working for my dad, I was his ears, but it was never a thing. I didn't think. It was just purely there was a lot of mashups going on at the time. At that time in 98, 99, wherever it was, I can't remember, 2000. It was later, 2002, I suppose. And Cirque and the Beatles had done this deal to do a show, and my father was very ill, and Neil Aspinall met, because I just had some success with the record. And I said, I reckon I can make a concert that never happened, just using the tapes and chopping them up. Mm-hmm. And that was my first, but I thought that'd be a fun thing to do. I didn't think it would ever happen. I thought I'd just get fired, you know, and I really did. I just presumed I'd get fired, and that was I just thought, well, this would be a laugh, and, you know, and here I am now. So it was never a thing. Yeah, it was never, it didn't even it's kind of a, like a reluctant, but at the same time, I'm deeply privileged. But do you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, I can't go. I remember after I didn't get fired from Love and it got the green light, so I did 3 months without getting paid, you know, trying out stuff. And a really good friend of mine, this guy called Chris Sheldon, who's a mix engineer, he's done Foo Fighters and stuff like that. He's a really good engineer producer. And I phoned him up and I said, it's weird, I've been asked to do this Beatles stuff. I don't think I should do it. And he goes, what do you mean? I went, well, I mean, if I do this, this is what... Because you know that people like the idea, you know.
And it's quite poetic.
Yeah, exactly. And he said to me, and he's really good, he goes, well, if you don't do it, I'll do it. And I thought, oh, right, okay, this is... I'm really lucky to be offered this, opposed to some spoilt, petulant child.
Yeah.
And it's really, and that's the thing, if you have a father who's like a legendary producer, you know, your levels of expectation are so much higher than someone normal. I mean, you know, I got nominated for a Grammy at the end of last week, and I forgot to tell my wife or tell anyone, because I just didn't think it really was that. And then she goes, you get on for a Grammy? I said, yeah. She goes, well, oh, I forgot to mention it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, because your level of, you know, my dad's George Martin. It's like, you can't win. It's really
but
weird.
But you still went into the same.
Yeah, but that's because I love music.
Yeah.
You know, I love me. I love sound. I love doing. I love the fact that we can celebrate, you know, that I can stand in front of you and go, this is, or do something up in Liverpool. You know, I love Liverpool. It's brilliant. And do something up at the Tate and go, you know, families can walk into this space and enjoy the record and go, and they I don't think they'll think about the mix or the technology. I hope they don't. I just hope they hear it. They think about how the sound, and simplified by four blokes in a room, created this sound that emanates and will affect them and give them something to think about later on. And if you can pass that on, that's what you do it for. You don't do it because... Then you go home and you watch something on television and go to bed. You know, it's like, you know, but that's the life. It's great.
And is it important that you're bringing this to Liverpool in particular?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think that it's important to the Beatles as well. You know, Liverpool is their home. They have ties there. They have, and it's a city of culture. You know, it's not just the Beatles, but it is a city of culture. And it makes sense, in the same way you asked me a question about, you know, me being George Martin's son and working on the Beatles music, it makes sense for this be the Liverpool to be the first place that people get to hear this. And, in you know, it's ambitious what we're doing, but I think it'll be great.
If you're enjoying Beatles City, please remember to subscribe, rate and review it on your favourite podcast app. Join us next week when Ellen will be back from her holiday to tell us all about meeting a Merseybeat musician whose career took a wrong turn.